Hello and welcome to the Middle East Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Middle East and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. It has been 1 year since Uzbek police and security forces broke up peaceful protests in Karakol, Pakistan. The protests started over proposed changes to Uzbekistan's constitution that would have deprived Karakol, Pakistan of its status as a sovereign republic with the right to secede from Uzbekistan. When a large crowd gathered outside the administrative building in the Karakalpak capital, Nukus, on July 1st, police responded by firing tear gas and rubber bullets on the crowd, and that started the violence. Uzbek authorities said 21 people were killed, nearly 250 people injured, and more than 500 people were detained. These figures are disputed by some who claim the real numbers are higher. A highly publicized trial process started this year and is just recently finished. The 61 defendants were all found guilty, but there are many questions about the fairness of these trials and also criticism that no one from the police or security forces who were responsible for most of the deaths and injuries have been put on trial. On this podcast, we take a look at what happened in Karakol, Pakistan in the years since the violence and what the situation looks like today. And to discuss all this, I am joined by Gulaim Akhmedova, a native of Karakol, Pakistan, who now lives outside Uzbekistan, and we are using a pseudonym for Gulaim to protect friends and family back in Karakol, Pakistan, from any possible repercussions from authorities. Joanna Lillis, veteran reporter on Central Asia for EurasiaNet, The Economist, and author of the book Dark Shadows Inside the Secret World of Kazakhstan. Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer who has spent many years focusing on Central Asia and is currently an associate professor at the University of Southern California. Thank you all for being here. And Joanna, I would like to start with you. You were in Karakol, Pakistan right after the violence last July. Could you describe what you saw and what people told you about the events of July 1st and 2nd?
Yeah, of course. Thank you for the invitation. I think it's important that we talk a lot about what happened in Karakol, Pakistan and the situation as it is today. So, as you said, I did go to Karakol, Pakistan as soon as I could and arrived just as the violence was dying down. And what I found there was, well, for one thing, a very traumatized population. You know, people were very, very traumatized by the violence that they had witnessed over the previous couple of days. They talked about, you know, about many of them had witnessed people being hit by. Well, they were never sure exactly what they had been hit by, but they saw people, you know, their bodies kind of torn apart by whatever hit them. They saw people dying in front of them, and they also saw the police using the security forces using what they said was a lot of violence against people as they tried to disperse what had become violent clashes. Now, all of the people, indeed, that I spoke to, other than members of the security forces, did say that the violence had started because the security forces tried to disperse the protests and started firing rubber bullets rather indiscriminately. Now, I didn't witness that, so I can't say. The security forces said they were attacked by protesters. The other thing that was very notable when I was there was the sweeping nature of the detentions. Now, outside the police station, there was a large crowd of several hundred people all seeking news of their relatives, and many of them were very, very frantic because they didn't know if the relatives had disappeared. They didn't know if they'd been arrested or if they'd been killed, injured. So they were frantically going around the police station and around the hospitals and around the morgues. I also went to the morgue and witnessed a man come out after identifying the body of his younger brother who was killed in the protest. He was absolutely, as you can imagine, distraught. The relatives outside the police station also very, very, very frightened and anxious. They were frightened. For them, the best option was to find that their relative was in the police station, but they were afraid that they were being mistreated, tortured inside, because, you know, for all of the talk of eradicating torture in Uzbekistan in recent years, it has not been eradicated. So there was a very, very, very tense situation when I was there in early July. The police themselves detained me briefly, and they did then allow me, after checking with Tashkent, that I was an accredited journalist, they did allow me to continue my reporting. But as I say, a very tense situation and a very, very traumatized population. So that was the situation.
Okay. Thank you, Joanna. Let me ask Gulaim, if you could, I'm sorry to ask, but can you recall what you heard and the information you were getting a year ago when there was violence in Karakol, Pakistan?
Yes, I I reached out to some people in Karakal, Pakistan, and one of the persons that I spoke to was a medical doctor who works at the hospital. She said all of the hospital were packed by the people who were injured at the protest. And she said that most of the people who were in the hospital, they had the same issue. The snipers were targeting male genitals. She said that the hospitals were not equipped to take care of these people, and she was just devastated, and she kept saying that it's a genocide. And overall, I spoke with a number of people. They were angry, terrified, and scared at the same time.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so the violence is over, and now the investigation is starting on this. Steve, can you kind of walk us through the investigation and who they were looking for? Who ended up being detained?
Well, hundreds were detained in the aftermath. As Joanna said, it was chaos during the violence. We know that excessive and disproportionate lethal force was used by security forces. And to date, a year later, we have very skim reports, very sort of murky reports, incomplete reports that I believe three law enforcement officials have been either charged or perhaps detained and charged, and no real update on that case, although that is really the central question that everyone has been asking from day one is, will there be accountability for those deaths, for that use of lethal force? And of course, the government made a lot of news and called attention to the fact. And I think one of the biggest differences, the Uzbek government knew the moment after this happened that there would be parallels drawn with the 2005 Andijan massacre, for which Uzbekistan's human rights record was really defined by this during the Karimov period. And therefore, one of the biggest aspects, one of the biggest differences the Uzbek government tried to draw was that they announced the creation of an independent, so-called independent parliamentary commission, independent parliamentary investigation, made up of by one former political prisoner, Azam Farmonov, also an activist, Gulnoz Mamrasulova, a human rights defender. But by and large, the committee, the commission was made up of by people affiliated with the government, and it really didn't meet standards for independence that we get from international standards in terms of how these investigations should be handled. But we're still here a year later, not having seen the report of the parliamentary commission, and all throughout the process, as you mentioned, these trials of 61 individuals, the members of the parliamentary commission have largely been cheerleading the government prosecution process. In some cases, they've been participating in what I would call highly theatrical, and of course, Joanna attended aspects of these trials, but highly orchestrated and theatrical performances and these trials, acts of contrition and acts of mercy. So we have seen a number of individuals released by the government. And in fact, as you noted, Bruce, I think in the beginning, the most recent appeal to the Supreme Court just earlier this month did result in the reduction of some of the sentences. I think eight individuals were additionally released from detention or from imprisonment. Another four individuals who had been threatened with having harsher sentences, who were under house arrest, were not placed in harsher punishment. Of course, those are things that certainly the human rights community and journalists, I think, you know, obviously think is important. But at the heart of this, the trials did not meet international standards of fairness. There has been no release of this supposedly independent investigation by the Parliamentary Commission. And as I said in the beginning, no accountability on the actual use of lethal force by police and officials. And also, really, at the end of the day, no truth-telling about what actually happened. And I should also note, unless perhaps you or Joanna or Guillaume have seen this, I still have not seen official lists of the names of those killed, the names of the dead, which is so important for an accounting of the truth and also, of course, for the relatives of those who died. And so therefore, we're still left with many, many outstanding questions. And one, of course, thing to add to this, you know, as Guliaim powerfully mentioned, this perception of repression, a reality and a perception of repression, one should say that it was clear that the events that took place in Karakalpakstan, they really shined a light on ethnic minorities, this issue in Uzbekistan, the rights of Karakalpaks, the issue of language, of autonomy, of education, of all of these rights that were really at the heart of these protests, the largest protest in Uzbekistan's history, perhaps. And none of those issues have really either been addressed, although we have seen President Mirziyoyev starting his now presidential campaign for the fresh elections that are about to begin in Karakalpakstan, and really smoothing over these issues as much as possible and trying to, I think, make promises of additional economic incentives to the region, which is something that we've seen before. So all of these things have taken place, but the largest ingredients of justice and accountability still remain absent.
Thanks, Steve. And as you mentioned, Joanna, you actually attended some of these trials. Could you tell us what was the atmosphere like when you went in? I mean, they made a big deal of saying we're going to use the language, Karakalpak language in this, but of course they moved the venue out of the Karakalpakstan Republic for the trials.
Yes, I did attend some of the trials. Indeed, the first trials were held in Bukhara, which is what 500 kilometers from Nukus, the epicenter of the protests. Now, the authorities said that was because repair work, maintenance work, going on in the remand center in Nukus, so they couldn't hold the detainees there. Now, but some of the relatives that I spoke to were pretty distressed about that. You can imagine it's very hard for people to travel 500 kilometers to a trial. To support their relatives, and it's expensive too, and people in Karakalpakstan are far from rich. Now the trials, the trial in Bukhara was the first trials. There were two trials, the mass trials involving about 60 people. And I attended 3 days of the trial, what we might call the main trial, where the better known defendants were. Now that's Dawlet Murat, Teshi Muratov, for example, lawyer and journalist, and then Lalagul Kalikhanova, a journalist, some of the more prominent community leaders. I attended the trial there, and then I attended a session of the appeal at the Supreme Court recently, back in April. Now, what I would say about that, certainly the government was eager to present a perception that times have changed since the Karimov era, and these trials are open. Hence, I was able to access them without any problems as a journalist. So they were eager to show an openness and to show that due process was being followed. But and this is a big but, I would echo what Steve said. I mean, I'm not an expert like Steve is on this, but the trials clearly didn't meet international standards and international standards of proof that would be required for convictions. Now, in fact, I met Dalit Murat Tajimuratov's lawyer today. So Taji Muratov got 16 years, and that was not reduced on appeal. Now, he has a lawyer called Sergei Mayorov who defended him during the appeal, and he listed to me numerous violations of due process. And also, I mean, the central fact is that the court produced in neither the first trial nor in the appeal produced no evidence that Dawlet Murat Taji Muratov called for any violence or called for the violent overthrow of the state. No evidence was produced. In fact, video evidence to the contrary was produced, where he was asking people to disperse peacefully. But his lawyer was telling me today that this evidence was slapped down by a so-called expert witness who said that he was saying those words, but his body language suggested that he was really, you know, calling on people to rally violently or something like that. We're talking about burden of proof here and about the lawyer complained of what they call accusatory bias, where there's a sort of perception, the presumption of innocence is being violated. And also there were the most extraordinary scenes. For example, I witnessed one when all of the defendants, who had all admitted a measure of guilt except for Taji Muratov, who denied all the charges, they all kind of got up and put on a show of contrition, bowing their heads and bowing and begging forgiveness of President Mirziyoyev and begging forgiveness of the Uzbek people. They did that when some members of parliament, who were members of the commission investigating the events, turned up in the court. Now, What does that tell us? Well, it's an extraordinary display. It made me think of a show trial, and it also you can't help but think that the defendants felt that the trial was political if they felt the need to invoke politicians, you know, and to put on this display for politicians. So while there was a lot of openness, and Dalit Muratov was given, he was allowed to question witnesses at length, to pull apart their testimony. At one point, when I was present in court in Bukhara in the first trial, he reduced a woman to tears on the witness stand, and she admitted she'd given false testimony against him. Now, no one was prosecuted for that. No one was made answerable. And that false testimony, you know, despite that false testimony, he was convicted. So there does seem to have been a perception, certainly, that all the other defendants were kind of encouraged to testify against Hashim Murata so that he could take the main rap, although others, of course, remain in prison and remain convicted. And the other thing I would just say quickly, the members of the commission investigating that Steve mentioned, who turned up in court and monitored much of the trial, where are the results of their investigation? I mean, it's been, you know, a year now, nearly, and they have not published the results of the so-called independent investigation, which is really quite shocking. Now, I spoke to the chairwoman of that commission investigating, the ombudswoman, when I was in court in Bukhara in December, and she told me that they would wait for the court and then publish to finish the trials, to finish and then published. But it seemed to me why would it have to depend on what the court finds? And also, if the commission finds something that doesn't follow that the narrative that the court found, then what happens? Well, we don't know, because that investigation remains under wraps after 1 year.
Okay, thank you, Joanna. And Steve, let me give you a chance to jump in here, since you're a legal expert. Having heard what Joanna just said, can you add a little bit to your impressions of the trial process?
Well, of the trial process, I mean, I think the trial process, as Joanna said, I mean, she used the term show trial, and I have to concur. I think, a number of us in the human rights community approached this by giving, in a way, the Uzbek government a benefit of the doubt, because I think, as Joanna properly said, there was a sense that there would be more openness. There was, again, this announcement of the parliamentary commission to begin with. Those were certainly important aspects, and not to be minimized. But as time went on, I mean, I think Uzbekistan looks profoundly less free, profoundly, in some ways, unfortunately, more repressive 1 year on from these seminal cataclysmic events. And from a legal perspective, yes, these shows of contrition, these remarkably orchestrated scenes, they really smacked of pressure on the defendants. In terms of Taji Muratov, he mentioned that after his detention, officials had stepped on his head. I mean, these were absolutely horrific allegations of torture that fly in the face of President Mirziyoyev's early statements when he first became president, that torture would have no place in Uzbekistan. In fact, he signed in 2017 a very important anti-torture decree that said that any evidence obtained under torture would not be admissible in court. And so therefore, these statements that he made, and again, this false testimony against him by that witness, all of this reeked of due process violations, extreme ones, and really should have meant that there would be a new trial, that there would be more independent observers, that there would be really a different process, one that would take place in Karakalpakstan, given the nature of these protests. You know, also from a legal perspective, I think we have to not forget the central role played by these extremism statutes in the criminal code, the ones for so-called overthrow of the constitutional regime of Uzbekistan, which are notoriously vague, notoriously overbroad in their definition, and really allow the government to prosecute anyone they wish. So Taji Muratov, the charges that he was eventually charged with, there were a number of them, but the central ones go back to the criminal code, are really the tried and true allegations or statutes used earlier by the Karimov regime and now, unfortunately, the Mirziyoyev government to prosecute political opponents. And Sergei Mayorov, who I respect so much, in fact, he was my lawyer years ago and represents many of those persecuted in Uzbekistan, he rightly called Tajimuratov a political prisoner recently. And I think that was after watching this odyssey unfold of these trials. So I think all the due process violations, they add up to some really serious violations that I think form the basis most likely for, you know, the UN Human Rights Committee at some later stage to call what happened in these trials arbitrary and unlawful. So I think all of those issues, you know, unfortunately, as much as officials in Uzbekistan would like to close a chapter on this, I think they've really just planted the seeds for, you know, living with this issue in a way that they probably don't want for many years to come, unless they're willing to take another look, unless the Supreme Court can act independently of the executive branch. And as Joanna said, I just fully agree, and I think Guillaume as well, that without accountability, this issue will just continue to fester. And of course, the relatives and the victims will have to live with this terrible tragedy unresolved.
Thanks, Steve. Guillaume, get to you. One, I want your impression on the trial process too, and also any other people you know from Karakol Pakistan, what do they say about the trial process? But before you get into that, just for the benefit of our listeners who might not know Davlat Murat Tajimuratov, can you tell us who he is?
Davlat Murat Tajimuratov, he is a lawyer, journalist, and a very kind person who helped so many people to defend their rights. He was a pro bono lawyer, and he is a courageous patriot. And regarding my opinion on the trial in Bukhara and Tashkent, I agree completely with Steve and Joanna that it was spectacle and show. And when this woman was a witness, she said that protesters were paid. And when Davlat Murat confronted her, she bursted up in tears and she said that she was forced to provide false information. And just that this is a tiny proof that everything else was staged. People were forced to ask forgiveness. They were threatened. Not only their lives were on threat, but their family members were threatened as well. And regarding the commission, independent, so-called independent commission, it wasn't independent at all. They were just doing what the government asked them to do. Gulnoz, who represents Swedish human rights organization, there is nothing Swedish about that organization. It was started by Uzbek guy who in Sweden. And Gulnoz herself, you know, she was covering up the evil acts of the government. When Davlat Murat spoke up about the tortures, she called tortures root treatment, you know. So even you could see how they try to cover up the government. So I wouldn't trust their report, even though it's taking them forever to make it public. And people in Karakol, Pakistan are outraged by the trials, especially since this week law enforcement officers who tortured a 32-year-old man to death in Andijan were sentenced only to 3 years in prison, while gentle-spirited Davlat Murat, who follows the law to the T, got 16 years simply for trying to organize this peaceful protest. So people are just very outraged in Karakol, Pakistan.
Bruce, can I mention another legal issue that I see at the very heart of this as well?
Yes, please.
Well, you know, one sort of cognitive dissonance here that I see is from the perspective of Karakol Pak protesters, including Davlat Murat Tajimuratov, the constitution, both the old one and the new one, after the referendum that was held in April this year, guarantee Karakol Pakistan under the constitution the right to secede. Of course, we know famously now these were the basis, this was the reason for the protests, was the attempt to remove those articles from the draft constitution. And eventually, President Mirziyoyev climbed down from that proposal, left those in the new constitution. But if those rights still exist in the constitution, then why would protests about that issue result in terrorism charges or extremism charges or so many harsh charges for those that peacefully exercise their right to speak about this issue or to advocate for this issue peacefully. If that right does not exist, then it sort of the entire premise on which these trials took place, again, when you look at all the due process, the absence of due process, the absence of evidence, really the entire argument, the entire basis of the trials falls away. And that does, I think, render Taji Muratov a political prisoner. So the new constitution, we have Article 89, which, again, guarantees this provision for Karal Kalpakstan's right to secede. And it's just something that, again, the authorities have glossed over. They've been unwilling to discuss. And again, I think one more issue also, of course, that we haven't mentioned yet is in neighboring Kazakhstan, we have several individuals detained on charges among the Karal Kalpak diaspora, people alleged to have been organizing violence from outside. And we had the authorities very early on blaming this on people outside. And now even further afield, as far as Norway, we have one of the individuals that's affiliated with the Alga Karal Kalpakstan party sentenced to 18 years in absentia for his alleged role in organizing these protests, although it's clear as day. And I think Gulyaim here might be able to comment as a member of the diaspora that it would simply not be possible for activists outside the country, so far outside of Uzbekistan, given their active and enthusiastic members of the opposition or the diaspora community, but unable to organize such large and unprecedentedly huge protests in Karal Kalpakstan. That makes no sense. And again, it just points to the fact that the authorities have not been willing or able to have a real conversation, a sober conversation about how these events took place.
Okay, thank you. We'll get back to the Karal Kalpaks in Kazakhstan real quickly, briefly in just a second. But I do have to remind that we're talking about Karal Kalpakstan a year after the violence. And my guests are Joanna Lillis, veteran reporter on Central Asia for Eurasianet, The Economist, and author of the book Dark Shadows Inside the Secret World of Kazakhstan. Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer who spent many years focusing on Central Asia, is currently an associate professor at the University of Southern California, and Gulayim Akhmedova, a native of Karal Kalpakstan who now lives outside Uzbekistan, and we are using the pseudonym Gulayim to protect friends and family back in Karal Kalpakstan from any possible repercussions from the authorities. And since Steve just brought up the Karal Kalpaks in Kazakhstan, I think it's worth adding a little bit about them. Joanna, can you tell me something about them?
Yes, indeed. There are a number of people, if I'm not mistaken, five, who are currently under arrest. Now, they're all Uzbek citizens. They were arrested in the weeks after the violence, but they were arrested by Kazakh law enforcement officers, who were accompanied by Uzbek members of the Uzbek security forces. Now, there is one particular case. They've been living in Kazakhstan for many years, and there were one particular case that I think shocked the many Karal Kalpaks who live in Kazakhstan was the arrest of a doctor. She's been living in Kazakhstan for years, and the Uzbek security forces turned up with the Kazakh law enforcement to arrest her, and she remains in detention center. You know, I think they were placed under arrest, and her name is Raisa Hudaybegeneva. They were placed under arrest for a year, I think, pending presumably deportation proceedings, but we don't have much further information about their fates. And there's also worth mentioning is the case of Niyatbay Vorozbayev, who was also tried in absentia. Now, he's a Kazakh citizen. He's a Karal Kalpakstan member of the diaspora living in Western Kazakhstan. And unlike the Aman Sagadulayev, who was sentenced in absentia also for allegedly stoking violence, now he's an active kind of advocate for independent Kazakhstan. Independent Karal Kalpakstan. But this Niyatbay Orozbayev is simply a sort of cultural figure who's run a cultural community and so on. So, you know, there's clearly, there's a lot of finger pointing at Karal Kalpaks in Kazakhstan. Whereas, you know, I've spoken to members of the diaspora, and what they were doing was, you know, making videos expressing their desire for them not to change the constitution, change Karakalpak's status. So, and as Steve pointed out, it's not a crime to discuss an independent Karakalpak stand. It's a constitutional right, in fact. And on that note, just going off the topic of Kazakhstan, it's worth pointing out that the government, specifically the Uzbek government, published its draft of the new constitution and specifically asked people to discuss it. Now, obviously, they didn't want violent protests, but they specifically asked people to discuss it. And that later, discussions that were held in Karakalpakstan were held up in court as crimes. And I'm thinking in particular of a meeting that some serious lawyers called in a room quite openly. They hired a room in a hotel to have a conversation about the constitutional changes. Now, later that was used against them in court. And how can it be a crime to discuss constitutional changes or to discuss an independent Karakalpak stand for that matter when it's a constitutional right? And how can it be a crime to hold discussions when the government has specifically asked you to hold those discussions?
No, great point. Great point. Thank you. Let's go to today and what it's like. And Joanna, I know you're going to leave in a moment, so I'm going to take advantage of you being here and ask you this question, and then I'll get to Steve and Gulaim also. What does it feel like today? I mean, what's your impression of the situation in Karakalpakstan today? The Uzbek government makes a big deal about sending officials. Mirziyoyev goes out there. They give them, you know, we're going to give you tax deals. We're going to give you this and that and that. Is it having any effect, or are the Karakalpak people just so skeptical about the Uzbek government, it's not making any difference?
Well, I was last in Karakalpakstan only in April when I went and met Daulat Murat Tajmuratov's brother, who's his public defender, and also met some other family members. And I also spoke to people about their feelings about the what was coming up, the referendum to change the constitution, but also more generally about their feelings. And I found that they remain both angry and traumatized. They feel that, you know, the people I spoke to, let's say, I'm talking about ordinary members of the public in the bazaar, people selling things and so on. You know, they feel that justice wasn't being done in the trials. They felt angry that being victimized, they felt angry that kind of the rest of Uzbekistan was kind of, they were being held up as sort of violent separatists to the rest of Uzbekistan. They felt it was unfair. They also felt, I think that, yeah, that they were being treated in to some degree as second-class citizens without the right. They weren't allowed to exercise their constitutional rights. Now, it's also true to say that the government and President Mirziyoyev have been trying to adopt some programs that would help develop Karakalpakstan, a region with so many economic and environmental problems. I mean, most famously, the site of the dried-up Aral Sea, a very difficult place for people to live. So obviously, there were a lot of frustrations about their living standards and joblessness and the environmental problems that they suffer from. They must have fed into the protests as well. Now, the government has, as I said, tried to adopt programs to mitigate some of this. And there are programs, and the government talked after the protests about how much investment it's put into the region. But I think people are not seeing too many tangible results. And so those frustrations remain. Now, it's clear that President Mirziyoyev, you know, feels he clearly understands that Karakalpakstan remains a very thorny region, republic for him to deal with. I mean, he started his campaign trail for this election coming up in July. He started that in Karakalpakstan. He's described himself as a son of the Karakalpak people as well as the Uzbek people. But I think, you know, there's been a lot of divisive discussion on social media. And I think another point worth making is that the the Uzbek people, I mean, in the rest of Uzbekistan, have also, to some degree, been fed a line that these are dangerous separatists. And so they don't have a very clear picture of what really happened and why it happened, or of the problems faced by their sort of Karakalpakstan fellow citizens. And I think that's also a problem. So I think those frustrations that exist in Karakalpakstan, there are socioeconomic grievances and frustrations, and now there are major political grievances and frustrations about the treatment of some of the people in the trials. So I think that the situation is going to remain very, very problematic for a long time to come. And I think also the fact that the truth has not come out about what happened, the names of the dead, as you mentioned, have not been officially published. The Independent Commission has not published its results. So I think kind of finding some closure for people is impossible in this situation. So it's the government's giving itself a difficult job by not, you know, there needs to be a proper discussion about what happened, why it happened, and how this can be prevented in the future. And also, if it were possible to have an open discussion about the status of Karakalpakstan, Pakistan, where people could discuss independence, I'm sure that would also help. But as it is, I see these frustrations, tensions, anger remaining a problem for a long time to come, although people will obviously be extremely frightened to express them openly, and even more frightened, of course, to go out and protest. So I think that's the situation in a nutshell.
Okay, thank you. Ghulam, I'm going to ask you about that too. What do you hear from out there, from out your friends in Karakalpakstan or other members of the Karakalpak diaspora abroad? And I have seen, you know, I follow some of the Karakalpak activists, for instance, and they've been saying, we want a peaceful protest in Nukus on this day. But you never see that there was actually a protest. I mean, so I guess it's still impossible for anyone to come out and meet in public to talk about what happened last year or ask for some kind of justice.
Yes, so the situation in Karakalpakstan got worse after July events. They face heavy repression. People are imprisoned without cause, beaten for clicking like on Karakalpak patriotic videos on YouTube. And just last week, students who said that Dawlet Murad's trial was not fair, they were expelled from university. And some members of Telegram channel, which is called Future of Karakalpakstan, they got warnings from the Uzbek government saying that they will be held accountable just for being member of that group in Telegram. They didn't voice any issues. So people getting lots of threats. Uzbek government also reached out to Twitter and tried to silence Karakalpak activists. And thankfully, you know, Twitter didn't follow their request. So right now, people are just so tired of the injustice. And some young people reached out to me personally, and they said that they are ready to sacrifice their lives for Karakalpakstan. And they asked me what they can do. And I begged them not to do anything that will harm their precious Karakalpak lives or the lives of Uzbek people. I encouraged them to search for peaceful resolution.
Okay. Thank you, Glenn. You know, I guess we get, since Joanna's still with us, let's get the last comments and we can get everybody in. And I'll start with Steve. Is there any possibility of justice being done? Is there any way that this situation can be resolved as you see it, as the situation stands right now?
Well, a number of things need to be done for that to happen. I believe first and foremost, the government still has an international obligation. It's bound under several treaties that it signed voluntarily to uphold its obligations to provide truth and accountability. That means it still must conduct an independent investigation that could include international observers. That's something, again, we haven't mentioned, that the OSCE and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights have also called for those things. And we should remember that Uzbekistan is sitting now on the UN Human Rights Council. So it still has an obligation to release the names of the dead. At a minimum, it must conduct an investigation. It should hold accountable the law enforcement officers that pulled the trigger, that killed people that day. That, I think, all needs to happen. Then we need to look again at these trials, examine each case by case, but certainly look at Taji Muratov. I think that appeal is certain to go to international institutions and will be looked at and scrutinized, certainly for the presence of torture in that case. I think Guillaume was absolutely right, though, that now we're a year out, we're looking at a case where the security services seem to be very enabled, very empowered to hunt down people in the diaspora. I constantly get reports from people in different countries who have had their accounts hacked on Telegram. The other day, we saw that Dawlet Murad's sister had her account on Telegram also hacked. presumably by people simply just trying to muzzle the messenger, silence activists from raising these issues. So we have heightened surveillance, and I think that's very concerning. That needs to, again, that also flies in the face of President Mirziyoyev's oft-repeated statements that he wants an Uzbekistan that, that prizes freedom of speech. We saw a really good report coming out from the Uzbek-German Forum for Human Rights on problems that bloggers and journalists are having in Uzbekistan earlier this week. And someone we haven't mentioned, Lalagul Kalikhanova, was one of those people that received house arrest and it appeared was pressured to make statements that, that really favored the government when she was let off, I guess, quote unquote, let off easy, not given a prison sentence, but sentenced to house arrest. She, for example, was a very important journalist and blogger among Karakalpaks and now is not doing that. So we've lost voices in this community. One other thing that occurs to me, Bruce, that's important to mention is that Uzbekistan was slated to conduct a census in 2023, the first time since 1989. And how will it conduct a census? How can it conduct a census when it's impossible for Karakalpaks and other ethnic minorities to really discuss the reality of their issues, to talk about education, when there aren't, when it's clear that international UN committees have pointed out that Uzbekistan doesn't collect demographic information. So again, we have a lot of outstanding issues, but at the very center of this is, again, I think the need for truth, the need for a sober, difficult conversation. Because I agree with Joanna that one thing that's really troubling is that many, many Uzbeks, and even in the Uzbek media abroad, there's still really this absence of understanding of who Karakalpaks are, what rights they have under the Uzbek constitution, and why it's not a crime to peacefully protest. I think that is so essential to Uzbekistan living up to its human rights obligations. The right to protest, the right to peacefully criticize is at the heart of any democracy and any constitution. And there's been so much discussion these past several months in Uzbekistan about a new constitution, now upcoming elections. That right has to be guaranteed.
Thanks, Steve. Joanna, last thoughts, comments?
Yes, Steve talks about the right to criticize, you know, and so we, and you mentioned the excellent new report about pressure on journalists and bloggers. Now, during my visit to Uzbekistan now, I'm speaking to you from Tashkent today, and during my visit in April to report on the referendum, I met several journalists and bloggers who all spoke of a markedly deteriorating situation when it comes to freedom of expression for the media and for bloggers as well. We've seen a number of bloggers jailed specifically on what human rights activists say are spurious charges that are simply expressing their opinions. But journalists as well are you know, obviously they talk a lot about self-censorship and say it's a means of survival that you have to self-censor. And they're talking, and in many cases they are afraid to be identified. In most cases, they are afraid to be identified. They talk of intense pressure in the run-up to the referendum. Some of them believe that the pressure started after the violence in Karakalpakstan, but many were certainly talking about pressure in the run-up to the referendum on constitutional changes that has allowed that the government says is to secure better the rights of the Uzbek people, but has also allowed Mirziyoyev to extend his rule. And the journalists that I've been meeting in the past week or so, I've also been talking about this kind of feeling that the gains that were made after Mirziyoyev came to power and kind of loosened the screws on the media in a very marked way, a very positive way. They're talking about these gains being rolled back. You know, so I think that there's been repercussions from the violence in Karakalpakstan and the government's reaction to it specifically, the inability to confront it openly, and the absence of also justice for the dead, you know, the absence of trials for any law enforcement people, that they still have no trials, no one has gone to trial. So I think the journalists are very concerned about this deteriorating freedom of speech. And it does seem, for me as a journalist, and it's something that I think all of us are very excited about after President Mirziyoyev came to power and loosened the screws somewhat. I think it's really sad to see that being rolled back a bit. And of course, we're going into a presidential election now. No political opposition has been able to form. The one person, Hidden Azar Alakulov, who's tried to form an opposition party, and of course you need a party to nominate you to be a presidential candidate. His attempts have been unsuccessful, thwarted at every turn, denied registration. And so I think that's also worth mentioning. You know, we're seeing Uzbekistan could be at a turning point here as Mirziyoyev extends his rule. And, I think some people would have hoped to see opposition in elections, not just the same rubber stamp elections as the Karimov era. And I think having a freer press, of course, the press wasn't entirely free, even after Mirziyoyev loosened the screws. But having a freer press is something that is a gain for all Uzbeks. And it also helps the government to understand people's problems. So, I think we all need to hope for some improvements on all of that.
Okay, thank you. Ghulam, we'll give the last word to you. What should people know outside the region, in the international community, and Uzbeks inside Uzbekistan? What should they know about the Karakalpak people and how they feel now?
Many people do not realize that in 1993, after the breakup of the USSR, Karakalpakstan signed a 20-year reunification agreement with Uzbekistan, which guaranteed the Karakalpakstan constitutional right to withdraw via referendum from Uzbekistan. According to this agreement, after 20 years, the parties would either extend the agreement or Karakalpakstan would hold a referendum on leaving and becoming an independent, free state separate from Uzbekistan. But there was no vote in 2013. Uzbek President Karimov locked up in jail anyone who dared to speak up about it. Razlik prison was used to put Karakalpak prisoners into boiling water for speaking about independence. Karakalpakstan needs assistance from the West to secure its freedom, and Karakalpakstan will offer several natural resources to the Western nations. The EU and the US should be involved in assisting Karakalpakstan to gain the right to self-determination. And the presence in Central Asia is a powerful, amidst the powerful anti-Western bloc of dictatorship of Russia, China, Iran, and Central Asia. We need help from the West and from the people from human rights organizations. And also I would like to end with a quote from Martin Luther King, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Please do not treat it as a place you have never heard of, but we desperately need your help. Right now we are facing ethnic cleansing. Women's children are being ripped off their bodies. Their uterus being removed without their consent. Harsh economic conditions are created in Karakalpakstan, despite of the rich natural resources we have. And also, Uzbek government appoints people who were born outside of Uzbekistan or Karakalpakstan to the key leadership position, who are ethnically not Karakalpak Uzbek people. And that's a spit on Karakalpak people's faces, that even their own people cannot be in lead government positions. So we just need help.
Okay. Thank you. And on that note, we will conclude this session of the Mejlis podcast. I'm sure we'll get back to the topic of Karakalpakstan in the future. So I'd like to thank Steve and Ghulam and Joanna for being on the program. And a big thank you to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcaster for Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asian Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you very much. We'll be back next week.